The largest Latino group in the United States is preparing to vote.
There needs to be more effort to outreach to the Latino community. I think that this needs to be deeper than just the kind of cliche cultural references. It's more than just hanging out with a mariachi. It has to be really talking about the issues that Mexican Americans and the Latino population as a whole care about.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Monday, October 26, we break down the Mexican-American vote this election in our series, A Votar. Also, how witchcraft has been seeing a surge in interest over the past few years. But being a witch looks a lot different than what we see in movies and TV.
It's also about how you feel as a human being and honoring that connection of your body to nature at large.
And first, we take a look at hunger in the United States, where it's worst and who's most affected amid the pandemic. The wrath of the pandemic, high unemployment, and months of government inaction have led 8 million people to be pushed into poverty since May. And as a result, more Americans are suffering from hunger and just not knowing how they'll get their next meal. According to researchers at Northwestern University, the number of food insecure households had doubled by June and tripled for households with children. And Black and Latino households are experiencing significantly higher rates of food insecurity during the pandemic than white households. And that's left food banks scrambling to meet the increased need. So we reached out to you to hear how you're dealing with food insecurity, and here's what you had to say.
Hi, this is Hannah from Levittown, and I've been working from home in a new job. I know everyone's experiences are different, but I've actually been okay because unemployment equaled working two of my jobs, which I was working before the pandemic hit. I'm okay with paying my rent, but next month I might have to start looking at participating in one of the local food banks, and that's a little scary to me because I've never had to do that before.
My name is Sunita. I live in Las Vegas. Getting food is always an issue, but during the pandemic, I got extra food stamps. When your income is already limited, everything is a sacrifice, a stretch, a struggle. The extra helped so much, but it was a one-time thing. So it was almost like a taste of the way life should be. And it was a tease. And I'm really hoping that America can be great. But I don't know.
Very powerful story right there, and thanks for sharing. Joining me now is Susan Goodell, the CEO of El Paso and Fighting Hunger Food Bank. Thanks for being here, Susan.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And Christina Wong is the Director of Public Policy and Advocacy at Northwest Harvest, a hunger relief agency in Washington State. Christina, welcome.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Susan, how many more people is your food bank serving now compared to before the pandemic?
We've seen about a 520% increase in need in our community.
You said 520%
increase? 520%
increase.
We see about between 6,000 and 8,000 families coming to our door every day. It is absolutely insane.
Christina, what about you? How has demand for food banks in Washington State increased over the past few months?
You know, on average, according to our State Department of Agriculture, it's been about a 50% increase statewide. But we really see that vary from location to location. In some areas of the state, they said their lines are about 30% longer than normal. And in other areas of the state, they said it's up to 300% longer than normal.
Christina and Susan, just want to ask both of you, what adjustments have the food banks that you work with had to make in order to get food to people? Are you having to get more funding? Are you having to give less food? Christina, tell us how you're adapting.
I always kind of joke that it's like Stranger Things. It's the upside down world for us. Under normal operations, 60% of what we give out is fresh or frozen produce. And throughout this pandemic, at the start of it, we were faced with skyrocketing need for shelf staple food items and a warehouse that was primarily full of fresh food items, so we couldn't really use those. At the same time, our pantry partners lost their volunteer force, since so many of those volunteers are seniors and others in high-risk populations. So we had to pivot to packing pre-packed boxes of shelf staple food items, and that's a much more expensive model between the cost of labor, packing supplies, packing space, and buying that food. And luckily, with generous help from individual donors in the private sector, we've been able, for the most part, to make up for an 80% loss in food donations.
Susan, what about you?
We have had to be incredibly nimble during this whole pandemic. We are the youngest food bank in America. We are 4 years old. And so we've not had the base nor the other resources that some of our older sister food banks have had. So while we ran out of dry goods, boxed and canned foods, within 2 weeks of our pandemic response, we've had to find other sources of food. So we actually pivoted to fresh foods, more fresh fruits and vegetables, frozen foods, that sort of thing. But we quickly ran out of those as well. And that's when we transitioned to products that were packaged for the restaurant business. So think about 2-liter bags of yogurt or 26 pre-cooked chicken breasts in a package, that sort of thing. We also had to transition the way that we were distributing that food. With 130 soup kitchens, shelters, and pantries that were dependent on our food, we could not quickly guarantee the safety of our clients at all of those locations. So we shuttered most of our agencies. We stood up 5 mega drive-through sites for people to come through and to have food loaded into their trunk in a low-touch methodology. We had 96 National Guard troops assigned to our location. But that has changed rapidly over time. The National Guard left in early July. Food that came from restaurants became quickly unavailable. We transitioned to government sources of food. So it's just constantly transitioning everything from the types of food that we were able to distribute and re-engineering constantly our distribution methodologies.
Christina, who is showing up for food? Are we seeing people, one of our callers at the very top said that they were considering potentially going to a food bank, but that they had never had to do that before. Are you seeing a lot of first timers, single people, families, elderly? Who is showing up?
I would say across the board, all that. You know, in Washington State, there was recently a survey that was completed by University of Washington and Washington State University, and it found that 30% of the respondent households were now experiencing food insecurity. And even more troubling is that 59% of those households have children. People of color were 1.5 times more likely to report struggling to put food on their tables than their white peers. Also, we could look for corroborating data from that with the weekly pulse data from the census. We're now seeing that 1 in 10 Washington adults with children are reporting not having enough food for their children. And that's really troubling because we know that those families will do everything they can to make sure that their kids eat. The adults will skip meals. And if we're at the point where adults are now missing, or now adults are now saying that their children don't have enough to eat, we're really seeing a food insecurity crisis turn into a hunger crisis.
Susan, the United States is, if not the richest, one of the richest countries in the world. How do you explain food insecurity at all? I mean, this just feels like it's absolutely unacceptable for a country that produces its own food in many places and has access to food.
I think that what most Americans don't necessarily understand is the disparity in income for people living in America. When you look at El Paso, we're talking about 24% of the population living in poverty. And then when you look at a term called ALICE, which is people who are actually working, they're above the poverty line, so they are not eligible for many of the programs, the safety net programs, that's another 32% of our population. So over 50% of the population for El Paso, for example, does not have enough income for a reasonable lifestyle.
Even given that point, though, that the federal government chooses where and when to spend its money, why isn't this a bigger priority, and should it be? And I want to pose that question to both of you, because there are funding issues that are funding problems at the state level and even at the federal government level. Isn't that right, Susan?
That's exactly right. And I think that the populations that Christina and I serve are often forgotten. And with their issues are not brought to light, so I'm incredibly grateful for you telling our story. We're looking at the government commodity trend line for the coming year. And in 2021, in the middle of the pandemic, the USDA is cutting the government commodity program in half, less than what it was in 2019. And these are issues that just do not get enough attention. And I think it's because the people we serve are marginalized.
Christina, there is still stigma because of that being marginalized, and just because a lot of people, particularly if they're first timers, have around accessing food at food banks. What would you say to someone right now who's listening but is reluctant to go there?
I would say we really need people to take care of themselves. You know, food is that catalyst that can help stabilize crises for people. We know that food insecurity persists because people are having to make what should be false choices. Do I pay the rent or do I buy the food that I need for lunch? People are going to time and time again choose to skip eating because if I don't pay my rent, my landlord's going to come knocking my door. But if I skip lunch that day, nobody's going to come knocking on my door. We really want people to not just consider going to their food bank, but if they are eligible for it, also applying for those nutrition assistance programs like SNAP or food stamps, WIC if you are a pregnant or nursing mother or have an infant or a child under the age of 5. All those resources, we know that it takes both those public resources and the private sector in order to help put food on the table. So taking, these resources are available for you to use. And people choose to decline using them for any number of reasons, but for your health and for your safety. There are resources that are available. If it's a matter of people are concerned or don't know where to go, your local food bank can help you connect both with those public resources as well as welcoming you and providing food at our programs.
Susan, there are people listening who are not dealing with food insecurity and who may want to find a solution for this issue that so many of their fellow Americans are facing, and some that might not even want to say that they're facing it. What can people who do have the means to help, what should they be thinking about doing right now?
I think we're seeing a time of unprecedented hunger right now, and everyone can be part of the solution. So I'm hoping that those people who are unaffected by the pandemic, they've not seen economic loss, they can help their neighbors. It is an easy thing to do to go on a food bank's website and to make a donation. Food banks are incredibly resourceful. Every dollar that we receive here in El Paso is 7 meals on a hungry person's table.
You said $1 provides 7 meals for someone.
That's exactly right.
Hopefully people are paying attention because that's a lot of meals in a very difficult time. So Susan, in Texas, there have been recent state funding cuts that have affected food banks, including your own. What have those cuts meant for how you've been able to continue to feed people, particularly as the winter months come?
We are deeply concerned about the cuts to surplus agricultural product funding. Those grants have been cut by 44%, which means 19.8 million pounds of produce is being destroyed rather than going to feed hungry Texans. And in many cases, this is food that is not harvested or it's tilled under or it's destroyed in some way. And it makes absolutely no sense to, in the middle of a pandemic, to reduce the amount of fresh produce reaching hungry Texans.
What's behind that decision? Is that happening at the federal level? Is that just happening at the state level? And if so, who made that call?
Unfortunately, many government budgets are in trouble right now. Income is down from taxes, and governments are choosing where and when they have to make cuts. Here in Texas, the governor has encouraged all departments to make a cut, and unfortunately, this particular program was slashed 44%. So we are deeply, deeply concerned about how are we going to get enough food for our people in need in the middle of this pandemic. And fresh fruits and vegetables is one of the best sources and the most nutritious sources that we can normally find. So we're very distressed about loss of this program.
I sort of talked about this earlier, but I'm wondering whether or not you're getting the help you need from the federal government to make up for that. But it doesn't sound like it right now.
No, USDA, again, is cutting these national food programs. The Emergency Food Program Assistance Program has been cut, and we're facing a cliff with government commodities being slashed and going to about half of what they were in 2019. Again, in the middle of a pandemic, when numbers of people in need are going up, it's insane to be looking at these large, massive cuts in federal commodity programs.
Finally, Susan, earlier in the Trump administration, President Trump decided to at least attempt limiting SNAP benefits for undocumented immigrants in this country. Are you seeing any effect, lingering effect from that as we are now in a pandemic and dealing with a food insecurity crisis?
I think minority populations, particularly Hispanic populations, are often frightened by the different things that happen at the federal level that threaten support. And whether it's cutting SNAP benefits for people who are documented or not, these have a ripple effect across communities like El Paso, which is an 85% minority-majority community. And I'm frankly horrified that this sort of thing would happen when our people are hungry. This is not a humane action, and we need to make sure that all people are fed, their children are fed. Without food, people cannot function. We need adequate nutrition for our kids to function in school, for adults to function at work, for our seniors to maintain cognitive abilities. It's unconscionable to be cutting food at a time like this.
Susan Goodell is the CEO of El Pasoans Fighting Hunger Food Bank, and Christina Wong is the Director of Public Policy and Advocacy at Northwest Harvest. Thanks to you both for the work that you do.
Thank you. Thank you.
When Donald Trump announced he was running for president, one of the first groups he disparaged were Mexican migrants.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're sending people that have lots of problems. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. They are not our friend, believe me.
Those comments set the tone for President Trump's large-scale anti-immigrant rhetoric throughout his administration. And yet Mexican Americans represent the largest group of eligible voters among Latinos in the United States. And as we've been exploring on our series about the Latino vote, A Votar, generational and geographical differences are a huge factor in how Mexican Americans are engaging politically right now. About 60% of Latinos who are eligible to vote are of Mexican descent, and that's 18.3 million people. Here to help us break it all down is Bernard Fraga, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University. Bernard, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
So when we talk about this major percentage of the Latino vote, who are we talking about? How do we define this group?
So when we think about the Mexican descent population in the United States, we're talking about a population that has been here for well over 150 years, primarily located in the Southwest, in the states like California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, but a large share of other states as well, especially when isolating the Latino population. In almost every state outside of the Northeast and Florida, Mexican Americans or Mexican descended Latinos make up the largest Latino subgroup.
Let's talk about generational differences given that. I mean, I've had conversations with folks who I've said, you know, if you're talking about the Mexican vote or the Mexican American vote, you know, you could talk about someone who's been here for one generation or someone who's been here for eight generations. How do things break down generationally?
So generation works in an interesting way for Mexican Americans. Part of the story is the narrative that is told about family origins. Immigration is a very salient issue to many Mexican Americans, even those who are born in the United States or whose grandparents were born in the United States. However, when we look at the population and think about age and generational differences, one thing we notice is that the citizen population, that is the eligible to vote population, is primarily US born, about 80% US born, and very, very young, millennial and Gen Z. About half of Mexican Americans who are eligible to vote are millennial or Gen Z. So generation plays an important factor, but it's much more about the narrative that's told about the immigration experience, whether it's a story about, you know, being undocumented and coming over, or about being here for many, many generations.
Now, where does race fit into this conversation? Because we know many Latinos tend to vote Democrat, but there has been consistent support for President Trump, despite his early comments that we just played at the top of the segment. Are Mexican Americans, or are some percentage of the Mexican vote right now still supporting the president?
Sure. So given the fact that Mexican Americans are such a large share of the Latino population, when we talk about trends in Latino partisanship, more than two-thirds of that is trends in Mexican-American partisanship. And what we've seen for about 20 or 30 years now is maybe 70% of Mexican-Americans identify as Democrats of the two-party share, and about 30% identify as Republicans. And even with Donald Trump running for office and now running for re-election, that Republican share of the Mexican-American population has continued to support him, again, despite that rhetoric. What we're not seeing is a large share of Mexican-American Democrats supporting or shifting their support towards Republicans or Donald Trump.
How much of that support for the president has to do with something that is often not talked about as much in Latino populations, but anti-racism, quite frankly?
Yeah, I think that's very important. So that feeds into both Republican identification, given the Republican Party's current stand on issues of racial justice, in addition to immigration, but also for the small share of Mexican Americans, especially in the border regions like South Texas, where Mexican Americans make up a large share of the population, their opposition to racial justice and really anti-Black affect is a big part of the support for Donald Trump. And you see this manifesting, and not just in terms of voting patterns, but in terms of attitudes we can measure. We can see that there is this kind of persistent anti-Black, specifically anti-African-American and anti-racial justice attitude that's held, again, among a small share of the Mexican-American population, but the share that tends to support Donald Trump.
Bernard, what differences do we see between naturalized citizens, Chicanos, and descendants of Mexican immigrants? Are there differences based on that?
Well, it's really fascinating because, you know, I think that again, it's the narrative that people tell about their family history and their origin story, right? So the vast majority of Mexican Americans are US born, about 80% are US born. So under some definitions, that's Mexican American or Chicano, right? Although Chicano is not a label that many Mexican Americans use anymore or use primarily anymore. But I think, again, it's about a narrative of the immigration story. If population says, look, born in the U.S. or have been here for many generations, maybe immigration is not as salient. For other groups, including for people who identify as Chicano, despite being here for two or three generations, still identifying very heavily with both Mexican kind of ancestry and identity, but also with that immigration narrative. So again, this kind of crosses the actual reality of the immigration story, and instead is about the kind of narrative that has been constructed. So for people who identify with that immigrant experience, whether or not they're immigrants or directly descended from immigrants, they tend to be much more positive in terms of their feelings about immigration and their feelings about the need for immigration reform. For others, even if they're immigrants themselves, they feel like they've lived the American dream, they might not identify with undocumented migrants, and they might oppose immigration reform.
How has the population shifted geographically? I think often we think mostly of California, but this population has also shifted. And I think we're seeing a lot of that even with the Puerto Rican population, which was traditionally in New York and maybe, you know, some parts of Massachusetts, which has also now begun to spread out across the United States. Has the Mexican-American population also shifted?
You know, I have to say, you know, yes and no. If we think about the Mexican origin population as a whole, we know that the migrant population, the non-naturalized population, has spread out into non-traditional immigration locales, places like North Carolina, places like Georgia. But if we talk about the U.S.-born Mexican-American population, and we talk about how young that population is, again, still primarily concentrated in the Southwest. 82% of Latinos who are eligible to vote in California are Mexican descent. 86% in Texas are Mexican descent. 87% in Arizona. So the mass of the Mexican American population that is eligible to vote is still in the Southwest. Although again, when we talk about younger Mexican Americans, the descendants of immigrants, that's where we see more spread in places like Georgia, Indiana, the Midwest, even the Northeast.
Bernard, one of the tragedies that we've experienced in the past couple of years aimed at Latinos specifically on the border was a horrific shooting that took place in a Walmart where the shooter aimed his hatred and his rhetoric at Latinos. Has that energized this vote in particular?
Well, I think what it's done is made really clear that no matter kind of your citizenship, your generational status, whatever progress has been made for Mexican Americans and for Latinos as a whole, that, you know, Mexican Americans, this is in the Southwest, right, still face, you know, significant discrimination and oppression, even in places where Latinos make up a large share of the population and have political power. You know, our communities are still going to be facing attacks. And I think that even the election of Donald Trump really symbolizes that too. Despite, you know, years of rhetoric from Republicans and Democrats saying that they were going to outreach the Latino vote to Mexican Americans, that this was part of the American story, and the appointment of Mexican Americans in high-ranking positions in both parties, you still see these incidences of frankly, racism and xenophobia manifesting even again for people who are born in the United States, who are citizens, who have a narrative of being in this country for 150, 175 years, still going to be facing these racist attacks.
Bernard, how well have either of the campaigns done in outreach to this population specifically?
Well, I mean, frankly, it's mixed. I think that when we think about campaigns, you know, in the 1950s and 1960s, really the origin of outreach to Latino communities, it was primarily targeting Mexican Americans and U.S.-born Mexican Americans who had been here for many generations. And that's still an important part of both parties' campaign effort. But I think that in the recent times, when we talk about immigration reform, the failure of immigration reform, and really the salience of Florida in the national kind of political scene, Florida, a state where Mexican Americans only make up 10% of the Latino population, you know, the campaign effort has not been targeted to the issues and the kind of identity of the Mexican American population. And I think that Bernie Sanders' campaign and his effort in the primary to reach out to Mexican Americans in the Southwest was an effort to shift that. I think that even the Biden campaign and the work that they're doing in Texas is trying to reach out to Mexican Americans where, if they turned out at high rates, would really dominate the political scene and the Democratic Party in a big state like Texas.
And I haven't seen as much as my friend Julio Varela often says, hispandering this year, which is pandering to the Latino voter population. Have you been satisfied?
Well, I mean, I think that there needs to be more effort to outreach the Latino community. I think that this needs to be deeper than just the kind of cliche cultural references. It's more than just hanging out with a mariachi. It has to be really talking about the issues that Mexican Americans and the Latino population as a whole care about. And that's more than just immigration. Again, 80% of Mexican Americans born in the United States, immigration is an important issue, but healthcare. When we think about the COVID-19 crisis that is disproportionately impacting the Latino population, the Mexican-American population in the Southwest, Latinos want answers.
And we'll see whether or not they get them come November 3rd or even now as we head into, we're in the middle of early voting. Bernard Fraga is an associate professor of political science at Emory University. Bernard, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you again for having me.
We're just a week away from Election Day, and so far, approximately 60 million Americans have already cast their vote for president. That's more than the total number of early votes that were cast in 2016 overall.
I think it's amazing, and I'm saying to myself that I never thought that I would be somebody to show up and stand in line to vote, but it's just how important it is.
Makes me proud to know that, you know, we're all united. It doesn't matter the color of your skin or your persuasion. At the end of the day, one man, one vote.
Some Americans have cast their absentee ballots by mail, but others waited on long lines for hours. And that was the case for nearly 100,000 New Yorkers this weekend, as early voting began in the state, the first time ever that early voting was allowed in New York in a presidential election. So we've been checking in with you about your voting experience and plans. If you voted already, what was it like? Did anything stand in your way? Or do you have a plan to vote on Election Day? We want to hear it all. So far, some of you have reported an easy absentee voting process.
My voting experience was very simple. I received the ballot in the mail and delivered it directly to the ballot box at the library, along with several other eager voters. We were all rushing to the box like kids rushing in line to see Santa Claus. I'm Barbara in San Jose, California.
My name is Brianna. I'm calling from Bemidji, Minnesota. I voted by mail, and I've been voting by mail since I was 18. Voting by mail really gives me the chance to seriously consider all of the candidates. When you're in a smaller town, some of those small candidates really make a difference. City council, election boards, all of that really makes a difference. And I like that I have the time to really Google and make sure I know what I'm voting for and who I'm voting for.
This is Suzanne from Raleigh, North Carolina. I voted about 2 weeks ago. I did absentee voting by mail, and I did that because I'm in a high-risk category for respiratory infections, and so I did not want to catch COVID. It was a very painless, enjoyable process.
For others, the pandemic has made voting much more challenging than before.
Hi, I'm Addie from Brooklyn. I'm 70 and diabetic, and I'm quite concerned. I sent an absentee ballot. The tracking shows since October 6th, it's still been out for delivery. It looks like it's lost. I very much don't want to go to my polling place. I don't know what to do. I feel I'm disenfranchised.
And others said they've gone to great lengths to turn in their ballots this year.
I applied for absentee voting in Dallas County, out of state at the moment, and only received another application for an absentee ballot, so I'll be flying back to vote on Wednesday or Thursday, depending on how long the lines are. Good luck, everyone.
For some, voting has been an inspiring experience.
This is Jeff Kingston, New York. Saturday the 24th was the first day of early voting in my state, and I waited online in Kingston for 2 hours. An amazing turnout. I've never seen anything like it, and I've been voting since 1965.
Hi, this is Mike from Santa Fe, New Mexico. I did vote early. Turnout was high, but the process was run very efficiently. Everybody was socially distanced and wearing masks in the line. Maybe the most encouraging thing was that there were supporters of the candidates of both major parties in line, speaking to each other as neighbors, as friends. The discussion was civil. And a lot of laughter, as a matter of fact. Mostly people were congratulating each other on the fact that everybody made the effort to come out and vote, regardless of who they supported.
Elise from New York City, East Village. I just finished early voting. It took me 2 days. I tried yesterday. It was a 2.5 to 3.5 hour wait. And today it was a 2 hour wait. A lot of poll workers, a lot of really helpful people. And truthfully, it was one of the most rewarding, heartwarming, poignant moments that I can remember in my 67 plus years. I am so grateful.
For some of you, the word witch probably conjures up images of pointed hats, black cauldrons, and maybe even some broomsticks. But for most actual witches today, the reality looks a lot different. Some do, in fact, cast spells, but not the kind of dark magic we see in movies like Hocus Pocus or The Craft. Witches also turn to things like crystals, tarot cards, potions, or altars. And though it's been viewed with suspicion throughout history, witchcraft today continues to enchant the popular imagination. In recent years, we've seen an explosion in the popularity of witchcraft across the United States, from practices rooted in English Wicca, to African Yoruba, to Latin American brujería. To explain our growing fascination with witchcraft and the role it has in our modern lives, we turn to two self-described witches, also called brujas in Spanish.
Hi, my name is Dr. Griselda Rodriguez-Solomon, and I'm the co-founder of Brujas of Brooklyn.
My name is Pam Grossman, and I'm the host of the Witch Wave podcast and the author of Waking the Witch, Reflections on Women, Magic, and Power.
Actually, defining the word witch today isn't exactly straightforward. According to Pam, it really depends on the individual.
My definition of a witch is it is someone who is a carrier of divine feminine power and who chooses to use that power to transform the world, hopefully for the better. But certainly the word witch has been a negative epithet that others would call outsiders and people that they hoped to oppress. So I use the word in a intention of reclamation and with a lot of love and positivity.
Griselda, what about you? What does it mean to be a bruja?
To me, a bruja is a person, a witch is a person that is very much aware of themselves in every capacity, from the highs to the not so highs, the dark and the light and the shadow. And for me in particular, as a Black Latina, a bruja, a witch, is a person who is reclaiming a level of power and embodiment in particular in the context of dehumanization. Whether it's a woman, a person of color, a queer person, it's a person who is unapologetic about their power, and the reclamation of that power has happened in the context of a lot of opposition. It's a beautiful identity, it's a healing identity, and it's an identity that has existed for millennia, and we're seeing a very beautiful resurgence of it again with the dawn of the Age of Aquarius.
Pam, let's talk a little bit about how you were drawn to witchcraft. When did that start for you? What was intriguing about it for you?
Well, like many children, for me, it started at a very young age. I loved fairy tales and mythology and spent lots of time alone in the woods in this kind of world of make-believe and play and magic. And then as a teenager, I discovered that there were whole sections of libraries and bookstores that had actual spell books. And so I no longer had to pretend to be a witch. I could actually buy a spell book and learn how to do ritual and how to cast spells and how to honor the moon. And it just connected with me on this very, very deep level, very intuitive level. My practice grew up with me as I grew up and got deeper and, a little bit more, I suppose, sophisticated, but is not that far off from what I was doing as a child in the woods, honoring nature, honoring my intuition, honoring the state of play that one can be in when one is truly free.
And Griselda, what about you?
My journey started before birth. My mother is a bruja. She doesn't identify as one because she still, has the word associated with the negativity and the dark magic. But we grew up in a world with altars and candles and ritual. So my mother became more connected to the Catholic Church in like our teen years and moved away from those practices. And it wasn't until my sister and I were maybe in our early 20s that we were intuitively called back to certain practices. We would go to the few New Age stores that were around and were reading about setting up an altar and working with nature, and a lot of it resonated. We were like, oh, this is what mommy did. So we became a little more intentional in reading and researching to put words to the things that we had already seen growing up. So it's been a beautiful journey to reclaim these practices in a very intentional way.
And I'm wondering too, what does that practice look like, Griselda?
It looks very different for different people, because just like there are different ways to honor a Christian faith, there are different ways that witches and brujas practice our faith. I know in the West, there's Wicca, and that's a very specific, like, established way in which witches, especially in the West, have developed witchcraft. But for my sister and I, it's very much rooted in a faith that's birthed out of the Dominican Republic and Haiti. It's almost like a Dominican version of Vodun. It's called the 21 Divisions or La 21 Divisiones. And it's very much working with the elements of nature to enhance the energy of a space, to create an altar. It's a devotion to God. That's also something that I always am very clear on with witches. We do believe in God. We honor God. It just looks different than what, Christian faiths have us believe. What the practice looks like is living as unapologetic and with as much integrity in every moment of your waking life as possible.
Pam, what about you? What does your witchcraft practice look like today?
You know, it doesn't sound dissimilar to what Griselda just described. I also have an altar. I celebrate the holy days of the pagan calendar. So these are holidays that mark the change of the season. I meet in a coven with other witches, and we celebrate the cycles of the body, the cycles of the moon. You know, that word embodiment, which came up earlier, is a really important one, because witchcraft certainly is about, yes, casting spells and doing rituals, but it's also about how you feel as a human being and making sure that you are generating and honoring that connection of your body to other people, to other life forms, and to nature at large.
Why has witchcraft become more popular in recent years?
If you trace the use of the word witch, it was almost always a negative epithet until about the 19th century with the first wave of feminism. And with every wave of feminism, we've seen a new generation reclaim the word witch and reclaim the archetype of the witch as generally a woman, though people of all genders can be witches and are witches, but it's generally someone who honors the feminine and who wants to subvert the status quo, because let's be honest, the status quo is generally speaking controlled by white, heteronormative men. When all of the major institutions, religious institutions, political institutions, economic institutions are run by the same type of person, that means everybody else becomes marginalized, disenfranchised, and disempowered. And so the witch, I think, is a symbol of power and agency and connection that really resonates with anybody who has been deemed other. And witches represent, I think, a new paradigm where more of us are honored, where everyone is seen as powerful and sacred.
A lot of the popular culture around witches, especially as we are right here on the fringes of Halloween, are, you know, very white. We're looking at Sabrina the Teenage Witch, Hocus Pocus, even Wicked on Broadway. Griselda, what happens when a lot of our imagery about witches is, and brujas to a certain extent, is really focused on whiteness?
Yeah, very important question. I think that it dissuades a lot of people of color from identifying with these paths and traditions because we don't see ourselves in them. I never saw myself in this imagery of the witch until, you know, I started doing my own research and looking deeper into different faiths and realizing, like, oh, so it wasn't just European women that were persecuted during, you know, the Inquisition and 400 or 500 years of these campaigns to terrorize women and working poor people, you know, because then these techniques that European men were enforcing and acting on their own women were brought to the so-called New World and were fine-tuned on the backs of indigenous and African people, women in particular. So there's a whole history that then gets overlooked before we go and jump into Salem, right? That history is the history that brujas of color, witches of color, are reclaiming, because not only is it about stories of people, of women that were violated, persecuted, en masse, and their legacy hasn't been reclaimed, but there's magic in that. I think it's important that my sister and I have this platform and so many other brown and black brujas and witches, because we're tapping into an energy that's very cosmic and it's very universal. But a lot of the practices that witches of all colors and backgrounds are practicing and reclaiming today are actually housed and embodied by people of color, by communities of color, indigenous people, African people. Their legacies, their traditions are being reclaimed in a beautiful way, but they're mostly embodied by white bodies.
And Pam, what about you? What are some of the stigmas or misconceptions about witches and witchcraft today?
Well, a lot of them root back to the 14th century when women primarily were being accused of being witches, you know, by the Catholic Church at the time. And so the association of women as being lascivious or evil, having some malevolent power, and being in league with the devil, you know, having some kind of demonic power, is something that was part of a very intentional propaganda campaign that then sparked the witch hunts throughout Western Europe and later in the New England colonies, you know, from the 14th through 17th centuries. So that stigma is unfortunately still with us. And it really speaks to our fear of powerful women or women who seem to be an aberration somehow. You know, sometimes women were accused of being witches because they owned land or they were older, they didn't have children or didn't have enough children. It still is a word that is used today to shame and silence women.
For those of us who aren't witches or brujas, I'd like to ask both of you, is there a way that some of us can bring some magic into our own lives, especially in such a difficult, difficult moment for so many people? Pam?
All human beings can benefit from ritual and from trying to connect with something that is greater than ourselves. You know, I call it capital S spirit. Some people call it God. Some people call it many gods. Whatever your paradigm is that resonates with you, I think doing some actual physical activity, whether it's lighting a candle or setting out some beautiful flowers or some kind of offering to that greater spirit, and then really mindfully putting out intentions and blessings for the most vulnerable among us, is a lovely practice that someone can do regardless of their faith or religious beliefs, because this world really, really needs those blessings and really, really needs us to all set our intentions to mindfully and actively transform the world to a place that is just and compassionate and healthy for everybody.
Griselda, what about you? How can people bring some magic to their lives in such a difficult time?
Finding the sacred in the mundane is a magical practice that can really enhance mood, that can really increase positivity, that can really uplift our outlook on life. It's finding the things that you do daily, like washing dishes or taking a shower or engaging with your children, and making that a magical ritual, a practice. And that means presence, because you get to appreciate the running water and washing dishes. You get to appreciate the awe in a child in the process of learning. And the most difficult but the most rewarding aspect of this little bit of magic that I'm imparting is being able to stay present and finding the sacred and the mundane in the most difficult moments.
Griselda Rodriguez-Solomon is co-founder of Brujas of Brooklyn and a sociology professor at the City University of New York. And Pam Grossman is the host of the Witch Wave podcast and author of Waking the Witch, Reflections on Women, Magic, and Power. Pam and Griselda, it's been wonderful to talk to you both.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. Supreme pleasure.
That's another Monday in the books, folks, and I hope you enjoyed our show. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about the person who could become our newest Supreme Court Justice, Amy Coney Barrett. And we want to keep hearing your calls on what your voting experience has been like so far. So keep calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and I'll see you tomorrow.